Good morning. Amen. That's good stuff. Glad that you're all here this morning. I want to thank a couple of you in particular who have been really helpful. I asked for feedback on communion ideas, and I got two suggestions via text immediately during worship. Our very own Rusty Jordan, our campus missionary, said maybe something intravenous, where we just put it right in people's veins. And then my lovely wife, who's at home recovering, said individual communion Yeti cups, the big ones that are insulated, and we hand them out. So let me correct that previous announcement. If you have any useful suggestions on communion, we'd love to hear those going forward. It'd be really helpful. The rest of you can be quiet. Continuing our series this morning titled The Strong Man, and we've been in the Gospel of Mark, and the theme from the series came from this passage we read 2 weeks ago in chapter 3, verses 24 through 27, where in the context, Jesus is being accused of casting out demons by the power of Beelzebul, the prince of demons. And Jesus reminds them that's a pretty silly idea. If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. If Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand and is coming to an end. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his good unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house. And in this quirky little parable, what we've been saying is that Jesus wants you to imagine him as a burglar, which is a little bit off the normal beaten path for Jesus. But imagine him as someone who has come into this world to steal you. Of course, you're rightfully his. So he's stealing you back from Satan, who has set himself up as the unrightful master of the house. And what Jesus is trying to communicate in that little parable is, no, you shouldn't be surprised by his awesome power over demons. It's not the work of demons. It is the work of God. He has come into this world fully prepared to overcome the obstacles that this world would present. Whether demons or men or whatever it be, that was the job of Christ when he came to demonstrate on every page of Mark's gospel his power over whatever besets us. As we've been going through then the gospel of Mark with that in mind, we've been asking, I think, the fair question, you know, what are the limits of that power? Or to put it another way this morning, is Jesus stronger than my circumstances? There's a tendency in Christianity, and I was thinking about it actually, if you only heard last week's sermon, you would have got kind of a part of the narrative and not the whole story, because there's a tendency in Christianity to replace faith with therapy, to turn Christianity into something therapeutic. And what I mean by that is we take your problems and we don't actually do anything about them, but we tell you how to feel better about them. And last week, I'll be fair, I did a little bit of that, right? I reminded you that even when your problems aren't removed, God is still able and powerful to conquer this world and to make you what you ought to be in the face of those obstacles. So, for example, in the case of Paul from 2 Corinthians, he had a thorn in the flesh. He prayed three times that it would be removed, this messenger of Satan sent to harass him. And yet God said, "My grace is sufficient." And you could come away, it wasn't my point, but you could come away with that. Oh, okay, in Christianity, nothing actually changes, but we feel better about it. And I think that is a bad version of Christianity and not what we want to believe, what we ought to believe. Yes, sometimes your circumstances will remain the same. Sometimes God demonstrates his power by giving you victory, even in the face of obstacles that he does not remove. That said, we do not believe in an inert or impotent God. We do not believe in a God who once upon a time worked wonders, but no more. We believe in a God who actually changes circumstances and demonstrates his capacity to do that. And that's the difference between a therapeutic religion and the faith of Christianity. We're not just here to say they are there, it's okay. We believe in a God who actually makes a difference in the real world. And today, to discuss that, I thought we'd look at a story that gives us a great example of God changing some circumstances. This comes from Mark again, chapter 4, verses 35 through 36. And it begins as a fairly ordinary day. On that day, and it could have been any day, On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us row across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. Okay, perfectly ordinary day. I mean, I know I'm not a boat person. I don't get on a lot of boats. But for boat people, this is an ordinary day. These are fishermen. They know what they're doing. What are we going to do? We want to go from here to over there. So we're going to get in a boat and go from here to over there. What did several of these apostles do before their life as apostles following Jesus around? They were fishermen. Getting on a boat was as easy as walking, right? This is a completely ordinary day. But you know enough, because you hear on Sunday morning, that it's not going to end as an ordinary day. Something out of the ordinary is going to happen. And the first observation I'd like to make about the kind of circumstances we encounter, what kind of circumstances and obstacles are the scariest? It's actually this kind. It's the kind that arrives on an ordinary day. Storms are most frightening when they interrupt ordinary. When everything's going along, and if someone gives you some warning, it's still an obstacle, but it's not nearly as bad as when you have no warning. All of you, if you live long enough, someone you care for will pass. And there's two ways that can happen. It can happen in old age, where the family has time to gather around the person as they age and to comfort them and to share thoughts with them and time with them. And the last moment is kind of this beautiful send-off. It's still grief, but you were prepared, okay? And others of you have lost people in an instant, unprepared, no forewarning, no way to anticipate it. And where the other one is a bittersweet grief, this one's a gut punch. And we know the difference between those. And all the obstacles of life come in those two categories. Some of them you kind of anticipate. You know what? We're all getting older. My body doesn't do the same things it used to. But then once in a while, a doctor calls you up and says, "Well, actually, it's not just old age. You have this disease." Out of nowhere, right? And these surprises happen. One day you're going to church. Next day they say, "Closed for coronavirus," right? Things come out of nowhere. And you think, I didn't see that company. We didn't have a lot of way to anticipate that. And those storms that we can't anticipate well, or maybe we should say don't anticipate well, those are the hardest for us to reckon with. Because even the therapy version of this, where we say, "Well, it's okay, we'll get through it," is hard because we had no way to prepare ourselves for it. And that's the kind of unexpected storm that we encounter on this day on the sea in Mark's gospel. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was already filling. See, very quickly, and I like the way Mark writes it, this very quickly, and in not just a storm, a great storm, an enormous storm. Again, sailors, they know how to do boats. They get how to do this. They know how to sail. They've seen storms before, but not this one. This one came out of nowhere. They weren't expecting it. And it was a great storm. How great was it? That before they really knew what was happening, there's water in the boat. Again, not a boat guy, don't know a lot about sailing, but when the water's on the inside instead of the outside, we're in trouble, okay? This is an unexpected storm, and it frightens them. In the text that follows, we'll read it in just a moment, they are frightened, which leads me to a question: what kind of storm frightens sailors? Well, there's an answer. It's the kind that reminds them they have not tamed the sea. As you age and you grow and you have experiences, you get used to the ordinary storms, right? Let's talk about that just literally for a moment, because it's June in Oklahoma, and we probably should, right? We will eventually get some severe storms. We get them in the spring and then sometimes this summer. And depending on where you grew up and what your experiences are, you encounter those storms differently, don't you? Okay, I've lived in Oklahoma basically my whole life, not entirely, but pretty close. So when a storm rolls in and there's a tornado warning, my mother will call me and say, "Hey, are you in the cellar?" And I'll say, "No, I'm on the porch. This thing's amazing. Look at this." And we encounter storms differently because that's ordinary. I'm used to that, right? And it has to be a pretty ginormous one to get me to hunker down, just because storms are storms, they happen. And you have to think that's the same way for sailors. Storm hits their little boat. These are fishermen. This isn't the first windy day they've had. What kind of storm frightens a bunch of sailors? The kind that reminds them they have not tamed the sea. And those are exactly the kind of storms that challenge us in life. Those are the most intimidating, the most frightening, the kind that reminds you you're not in control of your life. You want the greatest, biggest, most fanciful, ridiculous myth of modern life? The idea that you're in control of it. Modernism believes that ultimately, through harnessing technology and intellect and good government and all the things we have at our disposal, we can control our destiny. One of my favorite poems, yes, I'm going to read it with you. My favorite poems is William Ernest Henley wrote a poem called Invictus. And I can't even read it without my blood pressure spiking, because it's just that good a poem. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I think whatever gods they be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how strait the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. Oh, you're gonna growl when you're done with that. It's like so exciting and heroic and gets the blood boiling, and it's wonderful and enthusiastic and wrong about everything. I love the poem. It's beautiful. I love to read it. I can't read it without getting excited, and then I get to the end and say, oh, it's wrong. Every word of that is wrong. You know what you're in control of? You know what you're the master of? Nothing. If last year has taught us anything, let it be these two things. Your parents were right when they said to wash your hands, and you are in control of nothing. That's the story of modern life. We have all the science and all the technology and all the government and all the policy and all the innovation, and germs can still kill us. We are not in control. We are not in control. And we try. We try so desperately. We will go to great lengths to be in control. I haven't mentioned this from the pulpit yet, but I'll say it now so that I can stop repeating it. Several of you have said, hey, Ben, you've lost a little weight. Thank you. Appreciate that. The story of how I lost a little weight is an example of a guy trying to take control of his life who can't. Okay. This last May, Celine's diagnosed with breast cancer, and it's been a weird year. And somewhere around winter, I look at myself in the mirror, and I'm 320 pounds, and my dad had a heart attack in his late 40s as a preacher for a Church of Christ. You see where this is going? And I'm thinking, you know, it would not take much for my kids to be orphans. And so I have this nightmare scenario of having a heart attack due to my weight and Celine's health taking a continued detour. And so I decide I'm going to lose weight regardless. I go, you know, like every sane person, I went to Tijuana and had a nice doctor remove 90% of my stomach in March. Yeah, it's a fun way to do it. So, you know, you stop eating and it turns out you lose weight. So I had gastric sleeve, had that done. I've lost weight. And you know what? I still might die. I mean, when you think about it, perfectly healthy people still have heart attacks. Like, I will go to any lengths. I have this thought, it's Father's Day, I'm thinking as a parent, I would go to any lengths to make sure my kids have a healthy parent no matter what. And we did everything we could do, and I got to the end and it occurred to me, I could still die. There is nothing that keeps me alive but, I don't know, the good grace of God. That there are things in this life that I have zero control over. Gave me an excuse to buy new shirts, which has been fun. But at the end of the day, that's about all I'm in control of, what size of shirt I buy. There's a reason that Paul in the New Testament says bodily, you can read it out of the King James, bodily exercise profiteth little, right? Because it doesn't get you very far. That ultimately, something's going to kill you. You don't have control over the scariest parts of life. That's what frightens us. You understand? It's not the power of the storm. It's the fact that we don't have control over it. It is the lack of security that terrifies us. Politicians know this. This is how every political campaign goes, both parties. This is the political campaign for president. Here's how it goes every 4 years. Bad things are gonna happen, but I can fix it. Vote for me or we'll be out of control. See? And they are appealing to your desire for security. I can rein things back in. I can make them better. Because we never want to look in the mirror one day and realize that we're out of control, but we are. Most of our life is not in our control. And so at last, they turned to the man asleep in the stern of the ship. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Or again, because I grew up with the King James Bible, "Carest thou not that we perish?" Notice the supreme difference in the two behaviors. Jesus asleep, carefree on his cushion, doing just fine. Sailors ready to die, making their peace, and screaming to their master, "Don't you even care?" Notice they're not saying, "Could you do something about the storm?" It's not what they say. They don't say, "Hey, you're a miracle worker who can calm the sea. Why don't you do that?" What they ask is, "Don't you care that we are about to die?" Their shock is that he's not shocked. Their shock is that this is the time for mortal terror and you seem to be napping. And they're frustrated and they're angry about that. We rage so often against God in this way because we confuse effortless power for careless sleep. We assume because Jesus is sleeping that he must be unaware of the problem. Or maybe because Jesus is sleeping, he doesn't intend to do anything about the problem. Here's a crazy idea. What if he didn't need to wake up to do something about the problem? God's power, I think, blows past us sometimes because of how effortless it is. We want something to be done, and God tries to remind us over and over again, he's doing something all the time. You understand? He's always at work. He is upholding the universe by the power of his will. At the very moment Jesus is hanging on the cross, God himself is sustaining the nails that hold him there. But no part of this universe works without God's perpetual and constant creative power keeping it in store. God is in control of all that we see. But we don't see the smoke and mirrors and the flashy stuff and we say, well, God's not doing anything. Jesus was able to sleep because Jesus was never in any danger. Again, as the old song says, no waters can swallow the ship where lie the master of ocean and earth and sky. He was never in any danger. He, unlike the sailors, was actually in control even when he slept. What I want you to see there is not that Jesus has better psychology, he does, but that there's an actual meaningful difference in his situation. They were terrified because they were out of control. Jesus is asleep because he was in control. And that's the person to whom we trust our lives. And that's the difference and the confidence we could have in him. And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" With just a word, the God who spoke the universe into existence spoke it into silence. Do you notice the way Mark described it? It had been a great storm, and now it was an equally great calm. God's power over the circumstances was absolute. It didn't die down a little bit so they could just barely make it into the harbor. It dissipated entirely. God was entirely in control of their circumstances. He wasn't worried because there had never been anything to worry about. The sailors are out of control. He is in control. And that made all the difference. "Why are you so afraid?" he says. This man has the power over the sea so that our faith can master fear. You see, I don't have a solution for you today about your circumstances. At the end of the day, Invictus is still wrong. I can't tell you, You now are the captain of your ship and the master of your soul, and you will chart your own destiny. It will never be you. You will never have that power. You get some choices and some discretion, and you get some say in what happens, but at the end of the day, it's a really big ocean. You will never be in control of it. That's not the point of today's sermon. Nor is today's sermon trying to preach to you a magic trick that through invocation and magic words, we can manipulate God into calling his power down to harness the storms for us. The answer is actually much simpler than that. He already is. There has never been a moment when he was not attending to this universe. There has never been a moment when he was not keeping it in store. There has never been a moment when this world was out of his control. Every moment out of your control, zero moments out of his control. And because of that, the fear of insecurity, the fear of danger and peril, I can lay aside. Because I wasn't in charge of it to begin with, and the person who was still is. That same person is going to take care of my family regardless of what happens to our health. That same person is going to take care of our country regardless who wins elections every 4 years. That same person is going to take care of humanity in the face of all manner of evil that besets us. That same person spared not even his son to save us from our own failures and sins. How will he not freely give us all things? Of course he will. Of course he's in control. And I need not be afraid. At the end of that little story, the disciples are then faced with a powerful question. They were filled with great fear. That's the third great in the text, by the way. A great storm, a great calm, and a great fear. But the new fear is a different fear. Not the fear of being out of control, but the fear of having met the person who is. And they said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And folks, that was a rhetorical question because they knew the answer. There is no one in this life who can do what he does. The Psalms had told them this long ago. Some went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep. For he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven. They went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in their evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad that the waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven. That's a better poem than Invictus. You aren't in control, but the same God who always has been is, and now he's in our boat. He put on flesh and dwelt among us. He became us to save us. No water can swallow the ship where lives the master of ocean and earth and skies. Your circumstances, whatever they are, no matter how daunting, are not stronger than the master of storms, and he has never relinquished that title. Would you bow with me in a word of prayer? Our Father and our God, we thank you. In the face of circumstances unnumbered and unforeseen, we thank you, God, for your power over all that we see and over what we don't even know. Help us to accept with serenity the simple truth that we are not entirely in control of our lives, and that that's quite an understatement. Help us to be at peace with the circumstances that come our way that we cannot change, of which there are many. Help us by faith to trust your hand of guidance, to trust your care and your heart for us. Help us to trust in you, who spared not your son, that you will not abandon us or forsake us, and that no circumstance this world throws at us will catch you unprepared. Help us to find that peace in the storm, to find the same peace you commanded of the waves in our own hearts. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.